Dr. Mark Solms, thanks for joining me.
Great pleasure to be here.
You're actually the second interview I've had with someone from South Africa. Do you know of Leslie Greenberg?
Yes, I met him. I met him a few months ago. I believe it was in Bergen. Yes, it was.
Oh, wow. I hope that meeting went well. From what I have been able to communicate with him, he seems like a great guy.
Yes, I liked him.
Yeah, good. I asked you on today because I've been reading through. Well, before I get there, for anyone who's listening who has not heard of you or your work, can you give us a brief introduction on who you are and what you do?
Yes, I'm originally a neuropsychologist. I say originally, in other words, I trained first in neuropsychology. I also did some neuroscientific research I have done all my working life. But I took the unusual step for a neuroscientist to train also in psychoanalysis. So that's who I am. I'm a neuropsychologist, neuroscientist, psychoanalyst. And I have started out researching brain mechanisms of sleep and dreaming. And from there, I became interested in consciousness in general, and in particular, in that aspect of consciousness that is generally called affect. And they turn out to be pretty much the same thing in the sense that the fundamental, foundational, elementary form of consciousness is affect, in my view. And I've also studied various neuropsychiatric phenomena, which I could enumerate if you want me to, but it flows naturally from an interest in affect that one becomes interested in pathological states of mind, and mm-hmm. so that pretty much covers the range of things. Another way you could put it is that my focus has been on trying to integrate psychoanalytical and neuroscientific research methods.
That's amazing. Trying to integrate those two fields, has it been relatively compatible and easy to integrate, or has there been many areas that doesn't integrate well and you just had to right away, you know?
Well, it depends what you mean by easy. When it comes to the actual empirical work, I have found it easy. I found it easy. It's kind of like the obvious thing to do. The instrument of the mind, we can observe it from the subjective perspective of being a mind, and from the objective perspective, studying its organ, its physical manifestation, its physical correlate, the brain. So to me, it's the obvious thing to do. This part of nature can be studied from two different observational perspectives, and so it shouldn't be that difficult to integrate those two perspectives. They are just two aspects of the same thing. But what has not been easy has been the, shall I call it, sort of political aspect, you know, that neuroscientists and psychoanalysts don't get along. They don't trust each other, and they're very suspicious of anybody who has a foot in both camps.
And it seems like kind of what you're saying is they need not be.
Yeah. I think absolutely, for the reason I've said, they need not be. But psychoanalysts are nervous about reductionism. They seem to think that studying the physical aspect of mental states means to reduce them, if not to eliminate them. And that's, of course, not true. If you take the metaphysical position that I do, which is basically that these are two different observational perspectives upon the same thing. You know, one set of observations can't explain away another set of observations. They enrich each other. So that's the main worry from the psychoanalyst side. From the neuroscientist side, the main worry is psychoanalysis is not science. Psychoanalysis is hocus pocus. And that, I think, generalizes to subjectivity in general. In other words, they do take a reductionist view. They think that, you know, anybody who takes all of this subjective stuff seriously isn't studying the real underlying causes. Mm. For me, the real underlying causes are what unites the two. It's what explains both sets of observational perspectives. So as much as I faced all of this resistance, it hasn't really bothered me too much, to be honest.
Oh, good. Good. Would you hold to, have you heard of, or dual aspect monism? Is that what you're referring to? Yeah.
That's my position. It's actually quite funny. In my early 20s, when I was grappling with this, you know, because I think it behooves any neuropsychologist, the very word neuropsychology demands, you know, an explanation of, well, how do these two things relate to each other? So I think that it's especially important for a neuropsychologist to be clear about their position on the mind-body relationship. So it exercised me a lot when I was young in the sense of a young scientist. And I eventually worked out this position, and I was thrilled. I thought, that's how it works. And only subsequently did I discover I was about 400 years late. You know?
Isn't that just there's been a few things where I was thinking through all this stuff, and I was like, oh, that and then I found writings on it from, you know, yeah. That's just, it kind of just defeats your pride, I guess. Yeah. No, that's really neat. I'm in my 30s, but I've, over the last few years, I've been really trying to come up with a way of seeing things that makes sense to me. And I've come across dual aspect monism, and I think his name's Bertrand Russell, I think. Is that? I think he did some writings on it, and there's more that I want to look into that, but I think I saw an article. Did you write or co-author an article on the mind-body problem, and does that have to do with dual aspect monism?
Yes, I have written a few articles on that matter.
Okay. I'll have to check those out because I'm looking for more, you know, current. Okay. We talked briefly about Leslie Greenberg, and his theory of psychotherapy is emotion focused therapy. And he's talked about, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, maybe on a simplified sense, is that we filter everything through cognition, through our beliefs, through our thoughts. And his is more that it's affect or it's emotion first. And that sounds like what and I think with psychoanalysis, it seems to be the primary experience of consciousness is affect, right? Yeah. So those kind of, okay. And briefly, you mentioned earlier you could go into it a little bit more. Could you go into, if you understand the primary mode of consciousness or the primary aspect of consciousness as affect, can you explain how that kind of leads, or what does that do to the theory of psychopathology?
I don't know if I'm answering your question adequately, so tell me, follow up if this doesn't do justice to what you have in mind. But I think in psychopathology, our patients suffer mainly from feelings. That word suffering refers to the feelings. So the absolute core of my starting point in every sense of the word, including the most practical one, is when I see a patient, I want to know what the quality of their suffering is. In other words, are they depressed? Are they anxious? If they're anxious, is it fear or is it panic? You know, etc. Then the question becomes, why? Why are they suffering this feeling? And this goes back to what you were saying earlier about the distinction between affect and cognition. I think the role of cognition is to regulate affect. And to put it more precisely, the role of cognition is learning from experience how to meet our emotional needs. I say emotional needs because, of course, bodily needs are announced in the form of affects too, but we're speaking about psychopathology now. So I'm narrowing my focus to emotional needs. And by emotional needs, I mean things like the need to be safe. If you're not safe, you feel fear. Or if you believe yourself to not be safe, you feel fear. The need to have your loved ones available, close. If you don't, then you feel separation distress. I mentioned earlier panic. Depression is another form of the emotion that we feel in consequence of separation and loss. Anger is an emotion which arises from the need to not have frustrating impediments and obstacles getting in your way and preventing you from getting from satisfying your other needs. So these are needs, emotional needs, and the role of cognition is to learn how to meet those needs, which is hard, partly because the world is a very unpredictable and varied place, and partly because those needs conflict with each other. And that's a topic of special interest to psychoanalysts in a mental conflict. There's no such thing as a conflict-free existence. So as I said, my starting point is, what feeling does my patient suffer from? And then the question becomes why. In other words, how are they going about satisfying that need? And that takes you right back to the through their whole developmental history. The other particular focus of psychoanalysis is that we are not always conscious of what our beliefs are. What are the principles are by which upon which we act, and here I'm focusing on those actions which are intended to meet our emotional needs. So a big part of the treatment is to make the patient aware of how they're going about satisfying their emotional needs and resolving the conflicts between them, so that they can, as it were, reconsider how they're doing it, and that's what leads to change. Change arises from helping our patients to find better ways of meeting their emotional needs. So that in a nutshell is where I see the role of affect in psychopathology. It's not the whole story, but it is the centerpiece of the story.
Yeah, no, that's a great answer. Thank you. That's helpful. So one of the primary reasons I asked you to join me today was I was reading an article review of the revised standard edition of the complete psychological works of Sigmund Freud, which you were the primary editor or the only editor. I don't know.
I was the only editor of the revised standard edition, but the term revised refers to the fact that there was an original standard edition, and the editor of that was James Strachey. So James Strachey published or edited and translated Freud's complete psychological works as they stood in the 1950s and 60s, and then I revised that translation and the editorial apparatus. It updated the editorial apparatus, corrected the translations, and supplemented them with new translations of works that Strachey was unaware of or chose to exclude.
Okay. And in Freud and Man's Soul by Bruno Bettelheim. I've read that before, and I liked his kind of, I liked that book and the way that he was trying to argue for viewing Freud. And I had an attachment to that, right? But in reading this review, the review was written by Daniel Rosengart. He's a PsyD in New York. But he said in the review, Bettelheim would no longer be able to so easily claim that Strachey's usual translation of seal as mind instead of soul was a betrayal of Freud's fundamental humanist intention, because the revised standard edition has a lengthy entry on the word, 3 pages long. And I haven't been able to read that entry, but I wanted to talk with you today a little bit about Bruno Bettelheim and Freud and Man's Soul and that depiction of Freud. How much of that stands, or how much of that is just Bruno Bettelheim, you know?
Yep. So let me say, first of all, just to get this out of the way, because I worry I'll forget to say it. This is not addressing the question. Would you please send me the reference of that review? Because I don't know that review. I'd like to look it up.
Yeah, I'll send it to you.
Was embarrassingly, it took me 29 years to do this revised standard edition. Huh. And when I was appointed, which was 1994, as the editor, I had an entirely open mind. I had read Bettelheim's book. Bettelheim is perhaps the best known in general sort of educated circles. He's the best known critic of Strachey's translation. But the other main critics, people like Jean Laplanche, who was the editor of the French equivalent of the standard edition, and Darius Ornston, who's not known outside of psychoanalytical circles, Patrick Mahoney, also not known outside psychoanalytical circles, Adam Phillips, who's quite well known, etc. They all basically take the same line, you know, that this is a kind of a false scientization, and I'm quoting Laplanche when I say that, that it's a false scientization of Freud. So the fact that the publishers wanted a revised standard edition arose directly out of this criticism. Or shall I say controversy over Strachey's translation. So I had an open mind. My brief was revise it, you know. So I went very deeply into that literature, in other words, the writings of these people who I've just mentioned, and then some. You know, I had to read the literatures. About translation in general, about controversies in terms of what is and is not translatable from German into English. Freud is not the only thinker and writer in German who's been translated into English. There's a long tradition in related fields, psychology and neurology, philosophy, where all of these terms, or not all of them, but many of them, like certainly the one you've just mentioned, which is pronounced Seele, capital S-E-E-L-E, which is this German word for the mind. But it's also the German word for the soul. And so here we come to the nub of the problem. But before I address that problem, I just want to say I had an open mind, but on careful sort of consideration of it all, I came to the conclusion that the criticism was unjustified. I mean the criticism that Strachey falsely scientized Freud. But now let's, and I'm happy to, you know, to elaborate, but let's dive into this word, Seele, which is, of course, pretty darn central to the whole thing, because, you know, what is psychoanalysis if not a discipline studying the mind, das Seele. And it's therefore a word that Freud uses all the time. Here's the problem. I've already sort of alluded to it. There is no German word for the mind. The German word that we have is Seele, which means soul. And the other German word that we have is Geist, which means spirit. John Locke introduced the word mind into English, but nobody did the same thing in German. So we had the words soul and spirit in English, but Locke introduced mind. And so this is a great word to have. The problem is that anybody writing in German about the mind doesn't have a word to use. So for the most part, they use Seele, and they rely on the reader to infer from the context whether in using the word Seele, they are denoting this thing that we call the mind in English, which is an empirical thing, or whether they are denoting this metaphysical thing that we call soul in English. They are very different meanings, you know, but sadly in German, the same word denotes both things. There's little doubt, except for a very few instances, that whenever Freud is using the word Seele, he's talking about the mind. He's not talking about the soul. In other words, he's not talking about this metaphysical thing that may or may not continue to exist after our physical death. He's talking about the being of the human being. That's what he means by mind, the subjective being of the human organism. And that's not a metaphysical thing. In Freud, I mean, Freud was an atheist. Freud was, he had no truck with mysticism and religion and so on. In fact, he directly psychoanalyzed it. You know, he believed that those who believe in an immortal soul, that this is a wishful fantasy. It's a delusion. Clearly he wasn't writing about the soul. He was writing about something that's part of nature that we can observe, and that in English we call mind. You would have thought that Bettelheim, he was an educated man, that he would have known about all of this. But he was a complicated bunny, I have to tell you. he was a very odd man. And for example, I mean, I don't want to get, I don't want to upset anybody, but I just will mention it as an example. He was Jewish, but he believed that the Jews were responsible for their own genocide. You know, the Holocaust was a product of going like lambs to the slaughter. You know, so a person who holds views like that, holds quite extreme views. And I'll just add one further remark ad hominem. I don't want to be, but I hope I'm being sympathetic when I say this. I think that he was in a complicated state of mourning a world that he lost. You know, he had to escape Vienna, and the whole the book. Freud and Man's Soul, you know, it's a kind of a longing for something that has been lost. And I think that he's used Strachey's translation as the object of this mental pain, you know, that this is not Freud. This is English, you know, this is not the milieu, the mindset. You know, Strachey says at the very beginning of the standard edition, in other words, in his preface to the first volume, he says that in doing this translation, he's imagining Freud as an English man of science of wide education from the middle of the 19th century. And Freud, of course, was not an Englishman. So, you know, but that's what translation's all about. You know, you have to turn somebody's German into somebody's English, and there's always something lost in the process, and it's that loss I'm trying to personalize it by saying, you know, that it's not just a loss in the sense of a loss of meaning. There's a loss of a whole world that Bettelheim suffered, and I think he took it out on Strachey.
No, that's very interesting. It gives me like three or four questions. Well, one comment. I remember reading Freud and Man's Soul, and I was discussing the book with my friend, and he was also, well, what does Bettelheim mean by soul? Or if Freud did use that word, Seele, what did he, how would you define it? Because I don't think Freud believed in anything immortal. So what is soul? Is that just like, you know, and I was like, that's a very good question. And throughout the whole book by Bruno Bettelheim, I don't think he ever defines what soul is exactly, just kind of alludes to it. And so, and then the you mentioned kind of like mourning that thing that is now lost. It sounds like translations of the Bible. And if you're like a traditionalist to the King James Version, and then there's all these other translations, and you're like reading the Word of God, and when you read a new translation and it doesn't sound like the King James Version you were brought up with, it's just, it doesn't sound like God anymore to you. And I sounds kind of similar with Freud. Like if you knew Freud and you knew him in German and you were familiar with Vienna, and then now you're reading Freud, but in English, you're like, this isn't the Freud that I know. Right?
That's completely correct. I want to say two things at this juncture. One is to acknowledge that, you know, I've drawn a dichotomy here between mind and soul, but there is a middle ground. There is, you know, there's a way in which we can speak of somebody's soul in English, which does not imply, you know, something that exists outside of the natural order of things, something immortal and immaterial and etc. You know, we use the word sometimes or frequently to denote something about the mind in its depths, you know, your soul, and the mind in an affective sense, you know, a mind that feels deeply. So I think, in fairness to Bettelheim, you know, connotation, not denotation, that connotation of Seele, that ambiguity which Freud could exploit, the ambiguity of the German word. So I think that is lost, you know, by speaking of mind. It makes it all sound a little bit desiccated and a little bit cognitive, and I think that's true. But now here's the nub of the problem, you know, that in English, you know, when you speak of soul in a scientific context, you know, you're speaking about the metaphysical thing, you know, and it sort of calls into question your scientific credentials. Now, we must remember that for Freud, he was trying to bring subjectivity into natural science. He was saying, you know, being subjectivity, the inner world of experience, is part of nature. And so it needs to be included in natural science. You know, natural science, which aspires to objectivity, has to somehow sort of get over itself and accept that there is also a thing called the subject, and it should also be part of science. In fact, Freud put it very beautifully when he said, I'm trying to transform metaphysics into metapsychology. In other words, I want to understand metapsychology. It is like trying to understand what lies behind experience, and what are the actual workings of the subject. How does experience come about? What are the, so he when he says I want to transform metaphysics into metapsychology, he's basically saying I want to make this an empirical object of study. I want to make subjectivity an empirical object of study. And so his scientific credentials were terribly important to him. And so when Strachey said he was imagining Freud as an English man of science, you must remember that that this was Freud's project, was to bring the inner world. I mean, he coined the term Seelenapparat, which Strachey translates as mental apparatus. I mean, that captures the nub of the problem again. You know, the apparatus of the soul is a very strange, idea. But you know, the apparatus of the mind it sounds like something that might actually exist. It sounds like a thing that a scientist might devote their attentions to. But going back to what you were saying, now I'm making my second point. It's not just about that word. It's about this whole you know, milieu that was lost, this whole culture, this whole Viennese turn of the century world that Freud and his thinking was embedded in. And like what you were saying about, you know, the King James version of the Bible. I mean, that's we grew up with that. You know, I don't like this new one. And so what Bettelheim didn't like, and also those others who I mentioned similarly, was the whole scientization, as they called it. And so, you know, this is really the crucial question: was Freud trying to do science or not? Because if he was, then Seele is the right term. I mean, sorry, mind is the right translation. But it goes beyond just that word. What really gets Bettelheim's goat and the others is the Latinization and having recourse to ancient Greek neologisms, you know. So where Freud speaks of Besetzung, for example, which is a very ordinary German word, you would use it when you what Putin has done in Ukraine is to besetz the eastern front of it. The English word for that is to occupy. And when you go to the lavatory in a German country, you slide that little latch. It says "besetzt." You know, this is now occupied. So every German speaker knows the word "besetzung." You know, they know what it means. Strachey translated it as "cathexis" from the ancient Greek "cathexis." You know, like what the hell is cathexis? It's an invented word. Where Freud spoke of Anlernung, which means just one thing propped up, leaning upon another thing, Strachey uses the word, or coins the word, anaklesis. Where Freud speaks of Fehlleistung, which means something like a faulty performance, a mistake. Strachey speaks of parapraxis. You know, and so this is the thing that really got their goats, Bettelheim and all of them. Laplanche says of anaklesis, it's a lifeless and barbaric term. You know, there's strong feelings involved here.
Yeah.
Now, the problem there is that in German science, it's funny that you mentioned the Bible, because I think it all starts with the Bible, but I'll explain. In German science, you don't use Latin and Greek terminology. You use good old German. And I think that this starts with Luther. It's Luther's turning away from the scholastic Catholicism, you know, where you have to be a priest and an intellectual to understand the word of God. Luther's idea is no, you know, every person has a direct relationship with God, and they don't need all this apparatus between them. And so his aversion to turning away from the Latin and translating the Bible into ordinary German, became a whole cultural tradition. And so in German science, I mean, this is my theory. I think that's why in Germany is the only it's not only Germany, it's Germany and Austria. But German language is the only one that eschews the international language of science, you know, scientific terminology. So, for example, just to give you a sense of what's at stake, in German chemistry, we speak of two substances. One of them is called Sauerstoff, which means sour stuff, I mean, it literally means sour stuff. And Wasserstoff, which literally means water stuff. And so any German reading chemistry, you know, knows, oh, Wasserstoff, that's water stuff, and Sauerstoff, oh, that's sour stuff. But in English, in English chemistry, there's no sour stuff and water stuff. You know what those two substances are? They are oxygen and hydrogen, respectively. You know, so that's what's it. This is the conclusion I came to. If I was to translate Freud in the way that Bettelheim wants, it would be the equivalent, if Freud were a chemist, you know, of me translating when Freud writes Wasserstoff, you know, I would say water stuff. But, you know, this is the convention of English scientific writing. And in English scientific writing, we use words like oxygen and hydrogen. And likewise, in English anatomy, you know, we speak about the cerebrum and the cerebellum. You know what the German equivalents are? Grosshirn and Kleinhirn, big brain and little brain. So, you know, it makes it, if you translate Freud like that, you make him look silly, at least in scientific circles. And so it all comes down to this question: was Freud trying to do science or wasn't he? And Strachey is saying that, you know, he's imagining him as an English man of science, I think is exactly what Freud would have wanted. And I want to add one more point. Sorry, I'm really going on about this. But Strachey worked under Freud's direct supervision. When Strachey first started to translate Freud's works at Freud's request in the 1920s, Strachey was in Vienna. And he and his wife, Alex, met with Freud every Sunday to discuss matters of translation of Freud's works. And then when the Strachey's went back to London, they remained in direct communication with Freud by letter on matters of translation, for years. And when Freud became unwell, then they did so via the intermediary of Anna Freud. But there's tons of correspondence in the archives of the British Psychoanalytical Society between Freud and Strachey, sometimes, as I say, via the intermediary of Anna Freud. And there it's very clear that Freud strongly endorsed Strachey's approach to his the translation of his work. So I'm sorry, that for me is decisive. You know, there were even places where Strachey said, should I explain this, you know, this, should I put a footnote here explaining this word, anaklesis, for example? And Freud says, no, there's no need. And when Freud wrote to his English colleagues, he used these terms himself. You know, when Freud wrote in English, in other words, he used these terms that Bettelheim and everyone, you know, says Freud, you know, Freud would be horrified to be, to have his ideas, bolderized like this. It's just not true.
That's very interesting. There were a few holes, like the one that I heard that Freud and Strachey they talked about the translation often. And so it's like, well, why would he sign off on these translations? And I think the answer that I received was basically, well, he said it was better not to quibble and lose a friend than to find the perfect translator or something. And I was just like, I don't know. Yeah. You know?
So in fact, you know, I want to say one more time, you know, I have sympathy for Bettelheim. I can really understand what he means when he says something's lost here, but that I'm afraid is inevitable. So the question the argument that you've just quoted, you know, Freud's first translator into English was Brill. Brill was a friend of his. I mean, he really liked Brill. And it was with great sadness that he had to dump him as a translator because he was just not a good translator because English wasn't his first language. Then his main translator after Brill was Joan Riviere. Joan Riviere was a wonderful translator. And Freud thought Strachey was better. Ernest Jones, he played a big part in all of this. Let me just quickly mention him. He was very exercised by this task of making psychoanalysis sound scientific in the English medical world. You know, he was the great champion. He was like Freud. He was a neurologist, and he was wanting psychoanalysis to have the serious stamp of science. So he started a committee called the Glossary Committee, which included Riviere and Strachey and himself. That committee also regularly conferred with Freud on matters of translation. I've lost my train of thought there. He had to argue with Jones and say, I insist, I want Strachey. Jones didn't like Strachey. He preferred Riviere. So it wasn't just like that he didn't want to lose friends. I mean, it pained him to have to dump a Brill. He was very close with Riviere. Jones, he was more ambivalent about, but he was insistent that he wanted Strachey as his translator.
Okay. Yeah, that's helpful. That's good background information too. There was another portion that, again, I like the idea of, I'd like to ask you about, and I'm not going to be able to pronounce the German words, but Bruno Bettelheim talked about the two different types of kind of like science. And there was the difference between like the natural sciences in Germany, in German, and then the sciences of the spirit. More nomothetic.
The words are Naturwissenschaft, that's natural science, and Geisteswissenschaft, which is the, we would say, human sciences or humanities.
Okay. And he was arguing that psychoanalysis should fit more into the category of the humanities versus the natural sciences. But in America, especially in Bruno Bettelheim's view with the Strachey translation, we took psychoanalysis and we made it, it's all about science as in the natural science view, and tried to make it, if you're going to practice psychoanalysis, you have to have a medical degree. And then Freud was like, no. Then he wrote The Question of Lay Analysis. And so on like the tier of science from like the humanities, poetry, art, to, you know, the hard sciences, where would you say psychoanalysis falls?
I have to say, first of all, that Freud wrote the following sentence, psychoanalysis too is a natural science. What else could it be? Okay, so there you have it. In Freud's view, he was doing natural science. That was his whole aim, I say again, was to incorporate the subject into natural science. That was what he was trying to do. Now, whether the whole of natural science agrees that what he was doing was natural science is another question. But Freud was trying to develop a natural science of the subject. In other words, of the subject, the mind. Of subjectivity, of being. So that settles the question. There's a paper, it's one of the new introductory lectures on psychoanalysis. You know, Freud published the introductory lectures, and then later on in 33, I think it was, in the early 30s, he wrote new introductory lectures. And one of them is called a Weltanschauung, another untranslatable word, which basically means philosophy of life or worldview or something like that. And he asks, is there a specific special psychoanalytic Weltanschauung? That's the topic of the lecture. By the way, that word it was not translated. Strachey kept it as Weltanschauung because you know, many English speakers know the word. And it's not adequately translated by worldview or philosophy of life. But, you know, you get the idea, something like that. So Freud says, is there a particular Weltanschauung that belongs to psychoanalysis? Is there a specifically psychoanalytical Weltanschauung? And he comes to the conclusion, going through the whole lecture, at the end he says, no. Why not? Because our Weltanschauung is that of natural science. It's, you know, so we are part of a broader Weltanschauung. It's that of natural science. So to me, really, it's open and shut. You know, psychoanalysis in Freud's view was natural science. However, now let me add the footnote. Look, a natural science of the mind, you know, has to have it has to be able to incorporate. It has to be able to take into its purview all of the things that the mind is concerned with. And, you know, the mind, especially the human mind, is what we're talking about. I mean, it is a singular thing. It's the only producer of poetry. It's the only producer of art. It's the only producer of philosophy. It's the only producer of religious systems, of systems of law, and, you know, and all of that stuff that goes under the heading of culture. So it's not surprising that, first of all, that Freud applied psychoanalysis, and he called it applied, not pure psychoanalysis, applied psychoanalysis to the study of these things. And so, you know, I think that, you know, Bettelheim's not completely off his head, you know, to say that psychoanalysis must be considered a Geisteswissenschaft, it must be considered a science of a human science, or you know, it must, I think, a natural science of the mind must have a much deeper connection with the humanities than a natural science of, say, chemical substances. You know, so there is a secondary point to be made, but the primary point is, sorry, Bruno Bettelheim, Freud was absolutely clear on this question. And you know, again, there's the personal aspect. You know, Bettelheim was very hurt by the fact that he was not considered a proper psychoanalyst because he wasn't medical. You know, it's and that Freud was, you know, Freud was very unhappy with the Americans on that score. Freud didn't, as you well know, Freud thought there's no reason whatsoever why you should have to be a doctor in order to practice psychoanalysis. But the Americans disagreed. I mean, the American Psychoanalytic Association disagreed, and Bettelheim was a victim of that. And so, of course, it pissed him off.
Yeah. I had one more brief. Do you have like five minutes?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Okay. I've had this interview scheduled for about a month and or so, and since then I've seen various things randomly pop up, as they do when you, one, I saw an article on the conscious id. I think you wrote that in 2013.
That's right.
That was very interesting. I wish we had more time to ask about that, but maybe and then I just kind of have like a Twitter that I scroll through every once in a while, and I follow a lot of different psychologists and stuff. And I saw earlier this month, someone, Dr. Julie Gerner, a psychologist, she wrote that she said, sorry to break it to you, but dreams are just random neural firings where the brain constructs stories from memories, concerns, fears, and experiences. But she advised that we shouldn't ascribe much meaning to them. And there were people who were commenting. I was looking through the comments, and there were a lot of people that referenced you and your work. And I saw that you wrote, I think earlier to in the early like 2010s, you wrote an article on the neuropsychology of dreams. So maybe, you know, however brief you want to be, but are dreams just random neuronal firings? Yeah.
So I'll comment on both of these things, that question and the question of the conscious id. That Twitter post by her was sent to me. In fact, you left out the juiciest bit, which was where she said that dreams are random noise. Somebody questioned her and said, well, where's the evidence for that? And she quoted me. And she said, "Not Solms, showed this in the early 21st century, or something like, or the end." Huh. And that's how I became aware of it, because one of her followers or interlocutors then sent me that post and said, "Is this true?" And I said, "No, I'm afraid it's a misrepresentation." So it's true that I studied the brain mechanisms of dreaming. I published on that topic for the first time in any serious way in the late 1990s. But I carried on publishing several things on that, it's still at present, I'm still doing little bits and bobs of research on that. So here's the fundamental facts. I discovered that the brain mechanisms of REM sleep, which is probably what she had in mind when she was talking about, dreams being random noise, that the brain mechanisms of REM sleep, which we discovered in the 50s and which by the 1970s were being used to completely demolish Freud, because they are the REM sleep is driven by a part of the brain which has no motivational properties. And it happens like clockwork every 90 minutes. There's very little reason to believe that there's anything wishful or motivational or meaningful going on there. That was the argument. So I had no beef with that. I didn't care. I was wanting to study brain mechanisms of dreaming, and by chance. Discovered that that's not true, that the brain mechanisms of REM sleep are dissociable from the brain mechanisms of dreaming. In other words, if you damage the part of the brain that generates REM sleep, the patient still dreams. And if you damage another part of the brain, the patient stops dreaming, but continues to have REM sleep. So they're doubly dissociable. They're two different things. They correlate with each other, but they're not the same thing. That was my fundamental discovery in the 90s. Mm. And now the question is, if the brain mechanism for REM sleep doesn't drive dreams, what brain mechanism does drive dreams? And what I found is it's a circuit, which is, the technical term for it is the mesocortical mesolimbic dopamine circuit. But the functional term for it is the brain reward system. It's generally known as the brain reward system. Panksepp called it the seeking system, and Berridge called it the wanting system. So reward, seeking, wanting, this is what Freud meant by libidinal drive. So I think that if Freud had known what we know today about the emotional brain, and you asked him which circuit is most likely to drive dreams on your view of them being wishful, Freud would say mesocortical mesolimbic dopamine system. Dreams are motivated, dreams are deeply meaningful in the sense that they are driven by the part of the brain that makes us engage with anything. From the point of view of trying to satisfy our needs. The seeking system is fundamental to what matters to us, what motivates us, to why we do anything at all. So and in fact, patients with damage there, they don't only lose dreams, they lose motivation, they lose spontaneity, they lose volition, they become, sort of inert it's really quite something. So that's my answer about dreams. As you can see, I was able to provide a whole new line of empirical support for Freud's fundamental theory that dreams are wishful. And I say that because I want to use that to segue into your other question about the conscious id. That paper that I published in 2013, the title says it all. You know, the id is conscious. Freud said that it is unconscious. But there's a subtlety there that I think is, you know, very important to bring out. And it's this. The id is cognitively unconscious, but it is not affectively unconscious. Freud, the id is the repository of the drives. They're the driving forces at work in the mind. He says that the id is governed by the pleasure principle. How can anything be governed by a pleasure principle and simultaneously be unconscious? I mean, who ever heard of an unconscious pleasure? What's the point of an unconscious pleasure? So it is affectively conscious. The way in which you become driven is to become aware of the need. So, you know, we all have, for example, nutritional needs all the time. They're regulated autonomically until you feel them. Then it's called hunger, you know, and that means that you now need to do something in the world. And the hunger is the drive. Thirst is the drive. Sleepiness is the drive. Pain is the drive, you know, etc. The feeling is the drive. It's not the underlying autonomic need. It is the feeling of that need. Freud's definition of drive is it's a measure of the demand for work made upon the mind. So it's a demand made upon the mind, and you know, it's felt. So it's I don't mean to say that it's just a translation error. I mean it's a conceptual error. When Freud said that the id is unconscious, he should have said the id is cognitively unconscious. In other words, it feels things, but it knows not where the feelings come from, you know, but it does feel them. As I say, correcting him on that score, it resolves an internal contradiction in the theory, because the pleasure principle can't govern an unconscious part of the mind. Because it's governed by feeling. That's what the pleasure principle is. And the ego and the id is the ego is driven by the reality principle, and it constrains the pleasure principle. That's, you know, so the bottom up principle is the pleasure principle, and the drives are felt as affective, you know, demands. It's not just a semantic point, though. It's also, or even a theoretical point. It's very important to mention that this is where we started our conversation. In fact, I told you what my working life has been about, and I said, well, you know, from dreams I became interested in consciousness and in affect, and that they turn out to be the same thing. It's affective. So consciousness, the brainstem mechanisms of consciousness, the reticular activating system and the periaqueductal gray, these are the most concentrated consciousness-producing tissues that there are, if I can put it in that funny sort of way. They are also the font of affectivity, of raw feeling. So the basic elemental form of consciousness just is raw feeling. The fact that affect is conscious is not just a minor detail, you know, it's really fundamental. So the driving force, the parts of these brain mechanisms are homeostatic. They are the fundamental governing principles, in fact, of the whole organism, let alone of mental life. And so, you know, it's a very important thing for us to recognize. That drives are felt.
Yeah. It's wow. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. You've got to go, but thank you for joining me, and I'll be in touch.